Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCOU 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Kids growing up in the heartland. Jackie gonna be a football star. Diane's debutante backseat of Jackie's car. Sucking on chili dog, outside taste freeze. Diane sitting on Jackie's lap, got his hands between the knees. Jackie say, hey Diane, let's run off behind the shady trees. Dribble off those Bobby Brooks, let me do what I please. Say, oh yeah, life goes on, long after the thrill of living is gone. Say, oh yeah, life goes on, long after the thrill of living is gone, the walk on.
All right, welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm Al Warren on the West Coast. On the East Coast, we got David North Mellencamp. Martini. That's a little joke for the upcoming show here, you know, but we are working on Labor Day.
We are. What's going on?
For the listeners, because we care about our listeners so much.
We do.
Well, you do.
I do.
Everyone knows I'm the cranky one here. I don't care. Come on. But so now we're kind of going into the music world and writing world today. We kind of got it both going on. Okay. So you're sitting down, excited?
I am.
You're terrible. Okay. Well, so we've got this, we've got a writer here that's written a lot of biographies and things about rock stars and people in the entertainment business. So, and his latest book is called Mellencamp. And our guest is the author, Paul Reese. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Before we get into Mellencamp, you've got quite the history of writing about different rock stars, you know, Robert Plant and what got you down that road of writing about people like that?
I spent 25 years, God help me, as a music journalist in the UK, edited a couple of magazines. So pretty much all my working life has been spent interviewing musicians. So it was a natural next thing to do, to write about them at greater length.
You know, I wonder, but, you know, when you do a biography and you're telling about someone's history, that someone that's been in public like this, like Robert Plant or Mellencamp or any of that stuff, do you sort of get worried about how it's going to be received by people, and including the singer or star themselves?
I think if you were worried or you let that distract you, you wouldn't write a word, because dealing with musicians and rock stars, the most innocuous thing can upset them. The thing that you think might rile them beyond belief washes over them. I think you just have to you can only be as honest as you can be, and as careful as you can be with your research and all the rest of it. You can't worry what people are going to think about it, especially the subject.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, of course, but, you know, I mean, you've written about some big, I mean, you were doing interviews, but you've interviewed Paul McCartney and Bruce Springsteen, Bono, Take That, AC/DC, and Madonna. God, Madonna can kill a man at 10 paces. You have to be very, very careful, I would think. Because don't you worry about their fans if they don't like something you say, or?
It's the same thing. I think I always try and approach things. The people I interview, I tend to respect them greatly, be a fan of their music. I don't see the point in interviewing someone you don't like. I don't see the point in doing hatchet jobs. So I try and approach it from a point of as an enthusiast point, and basically wanted to know what makes them tick. I think Madonna's the perfect example of how you can offend someone without meaning to. Madonna got upset that I actually wrote in the interview that she looked into a handkerchief when she blew her nose. That seemed to cause her untold grief for months afterwards. But I go at it from the point of view of most the people I write about I'm genuinely interested in. I'm not trying to take them down or expose them in ways they don't want to be exposed or whatever. I try and do it from a fan's point of view.
Yeah, it's a good way. Do you ever find that, like when you're doing a book like Mellencamp, how was he towards letting you get into information that's private?
He was about as good as anybody can be, I would guess. I'd interviewed him at length on a couple of occasions. And then through him and his management, I was able to interview members of his family, pretty much everybody he's played in his band over the years, people who've worked with him, collaborated with him, management him and all the rest of it. So he allowed me access and let me talk to an enormous number of people who were close to him. And then he read the manuscript before it came out. There were several parts of it I thought he would take issue with or want toned down, and he didn't. The only thing I think, if memory serves, that he wanted change was I'd got the address on which his grandmother lived. I'd got the name of the street slightly wrong, and he wanted that corrected. But pretty much everything else, and at times it's quite warts and all, he let it go. I think he was very much of the opinion, or seemed to be of the opinion, that it should be a version of the truth, and it should be all sides to him, and that's what he's allowed to happen, to his credit, I think.
Now, when you do this, was there certain things that really surprised you about him that you didn't know?
I think there's always, I've been a fan of Mellencamp since way back with Jack and Diane. So I was aware of his reputation. You know, I knew he was quite hard headed and quite divisive. I think a lot of what I found out about him was through interviewing him the two times I interviewed him, which was 2010 and then again I think in 2014, 15, and that he's such a, I mean, he's a bit of a Renaissance man. He's obviously he paints, he's done musicals and stuff like that, but how genuinely engaged he was and curious he was and interested he was and articulate he was. I think the biggest surprise of all, I think, from talking to all the people who've worked with him is just that the sort of relentlessness of the way he works. I think it's surprising and not that surprising that he basically has never really stopped being bullheaded and plowing forward. But then that probably explains why he's in his 70th year and still making great music.
Yeah, for sure. So you liked him?
I did. I mean, I think he's the first time I met him, he did pull a sword on me. He was carrying a Victorian, one of those old Victorian antique walking canes that had rapier blades embedded in the top, and he whisked it out and waved it within about 3 inches of my left eyeball, and said words to the effect of, "I'll give you an hour to talk to me." I can't actually say the exact sentence as he uttered it, and he was quite intimidating for about 20 minutes. And I think then when he realised that it was actually, I did know his music, I was interested in talking to him, he lightened up, and he was fascinating. He was one of the few people, you could pretty much lob any question at him, he wouldn't take offence, he'd answer it, he'd be reflective of it. And when I went back to interview him the second time, he was about as warm as I think John gets towards people outside of his inner circle. But he's just a really interesting guy. I thought he was like a character out of American fiction. He's like something plumbed from a Faulkner book. He's this grizzled, cussed guy, but he's just got a really interesting story.
Well, you mentioned hard-headedness, relentlessness, tenacity. Do you think that's the secret to his success besides raw talent?
Yes. I mean, I think if you're familiar with his work, and John's pretty honest about it, it probably took him four or five. He had pretty much everything going against him. You know, he was from a small town in Indiana. David Bowie's manager took him on and saddled with the unfortunate name Johnny Cougar. And his first four or five records weren't particularly good. He was critically either ignored or reviled. And almost by force of will, he made himself really good. And I think that drive and tenacity, he's not stopped since then. He's sort of reinvented himself on a couple of occasions. He doesn't tend to stand still. He's not remotely melancholy about the past or backward looking. He goes forward. And I think that sort of drive, I mean, it's the same thing he shares with people like Springsteen and Petty. I think if you're going to sustain yourself over 40, 50 years in the music business, you have to be thick-skinned and hard-headed to degrees.
Mm-hmm. How was his health? Didn't he have some health problems, like heart problems?
Yeah, surprisingly, smoking four packets of cigarettes a day and existing on fried food gave him a heart attack in his 40s. and levels of stress due to his own his own demanding personality. Yeah, he had a heart attack in his 40s. And I think thereafter, at least he changed his diet and he started doing some exercise. He still smokes like a chimney. You know, I think that's as far. I think he'd had a scare before then. I don't think he's had any particular serious health issues since then. But then I suppose if you have a heart attack in your 40s, you learn a lesson, at least in some respects.
Or hopefully. I wonder, so when you say he's not your typical rock star, how is he different from people like Robert Plant and others that you've written about or interviewed?
I have to be careful here. I think that he's very, very self, or he's become very self-aware. He credits Pete Seeger, the folks, he had a conversation with Pete Seeger, and Pete Seeger said to him, if you're going to carry on for 50, 60 years, keep it small. And I think he's one of the few rock stars who's dealt with that with dignity and with grace, dealt with that business. When you stop becoming a quote unquote rock star whose videos are on MTV, he's played on the radio a lot, he's managed that really well. He's changed the way he performs. He's changed his music. He's become much more of a sort of folk singer. He's age appropriate. He terms it himself. He's age appropriate. You know, if you go and see John perform these days, he's more likely to be in the work suit he wears for painting. He's not trying to be Mick Jagger. He's not trying to be 20, 30 years younger than he is. He performs as he is, as a late 60, 70-year-old man. And I think that's to his enormous credit. He's perfectly happy with the audience he's got. I think the audience have grown up with him. And he said to me a couple of times when I was talking to him, he's not there to perform for teenagers. If younger people want to come and see him, great, but there's no concessions made to that. And I think that does set him apart. I don't think there's many rock star. You know, a lot of rock stars are cursed with this Peter Pan thing, and try to cling on to their youth. And I don't think he's done that.
Yeah. How do you think he handled being so popular once he got there?
Not particularly well by his own account. I think the way he describes it in hindsight is he when he got to the top, he had a look around, decided he didn't like it very much, and clambered back down pretty quickly. I don't think it was quite as simple as that. I think it probably brought out or magnified the worst aspects of his personality, you know, the impatience, the stubbornness, that he was going to trample over whoever he needed to get his own way to do things. I think that probably amplified all of that. And I think it did take him a few years to accept the fact that you can't do everything and control everything. But I don't think he was particularly comfortable being a rock star. I think the records he made, the record he made, Lonesome Jubilee and Scarecrow, are two of the biggest records he made. And then he made an album called Big Daddy, if you know that, which was much more downbeat, much more, and certainly wasn't pandering to a wider audience. So I think he had his time in the spotlight and has then very, very deliberately moved away from it.
Well, he's admitted that he had a temper. Did that cause him any problems? Did he get into any trouble?
I think most of his bandmates, past, present, past and present that you speak to, have had one or other run-ins or more run-ins with him. I think he comes from. I spoke to his brother, his half brother Joe, and he was very clear that, you know, they come from a long line. The Mellencamp men are fiercely competitive and have a short fuse. And I think John inherited both of those aspects of his personality. You know, he's quick to fire for sure. And I think everybody who's worked with him in the recording studio, in the live environment, has one story or other about John losing his temper or being on the wrong end of a tongue lashing. I think there was one record company executive he threw a chair at. There's another one he threw a punch at. So there's band members he's punched, summarily sacked, screamed and shouted at. So, yes, I think it's fair to say that it brought out his temper.
Farm Aid, did he start that out, or how was that? How did that come along?
That came because it was a comment Bob Dylan made at Live Aid. And I am paraphrasing him, but to the extent that this is all well and good, but we should also do something in our own backyard, and mention the American farmer. Willie Nelson picked up on that comment. Obviously, William Nelson's from Texas farming stock. Willie Nelson was looking to do an event. He'd enlisted at, I think it was Chicago, the first one. He'd enlisted the mayor of Chicago to get involved. And Willie Nelson happened to be playing golf with someone who knew Mellencamp. And he was talking about what he wanted to do. And the guy said, Mellencamp's just written this song called Rain on the Scarecrow, which is absolutely what you were talking about. And Willie Nelson rang John, and the two of them, together with Neil Young, were pretty much the driving forces behind that. And now Dave Matthews is also a board member. So I think that's typical of him. It wasn't something that was just a passing fancy. He believed in it passionately, and he stuck with it to the present day. That started in 1985, and he's still doing Farm Aid shows every year, and he'll still, when the need arises or when he feels he has to, get up on his soapbox and shout for Farm Aid.
Now, he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, correct?
Yeah.
What was his feeling about that?
I think typical, really. I think you speak to John, and when you ask him directly about it, will be quite, not dismissive of it, but it's very much like relaxed about it. He pretends he doesn't get particularly worked up about it. It's just one of those things that happen. I spoke to a couple of people who worked for him, a manager, someone who was his booking agent, and he said, you know, he dearly wanted to be recognised in that way. He'd been put forward, I think, two or three times and passed over. And the last time he was in, he was adamant he was going away on tour or on holiday, so he wouldn't be around when the nominations were announced. He wouldn't be disappointed. And from a couple of accounts, he was moved to tears by the fact he was recognised by his peers, essentially. I think one of John's great things, I think John, he's very interesting because he'd be very, very dismissive of critics. He's his own harshest critics, but I think he also, there's that burning thing inside him. I think he knows he's good, and I think he feels sometimes that he's been overlooked and unfairly. And I think that recognition is important to him. I think increasingly, I think his legacy and what and who he is and what he is and how he's perceived is important to him as well.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Do you ever talk about politics or that sort of thing?
Oh yeah. If you get him on politics, yeah, you can book an afternoon off. Yeah, he's got in his office at Belmont Mall. He's got a there's a letter of commendation from Barack Obama and Michelle Obama when Barack Obama was president, and he introduces that picture by saying, "I did tell Obama that I was way, way to the left of him." Yeah, he's very committed politically. I think it took a while. If you know a song called Pink Houses, I think that was the first time he really felt as if he got something to express. And after that, he's become more and more active. But he's very vocal about his beliefs. He famously wrote a song called To Washington, or covered a song called To Washington, during the time of the Gulf War, and ended up with people in boats outside the back of his house hurling abuse at him for being a Marxist and a communist, all the rest of it. And it bothers him none. I think he's, as he says, he's very much to the left of anybody who's ever sat in the White House. But yeah, he's passionate about his politics, cares deeply about it.
Well, I guess I would think that he'd be worried nowadays because people can just attack you nowadays. You know what I mean? It's not like where it's just a passing thing. People get really aggressive online.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much John's surfing the internet and looking at. I don't think he gets distracted in that way. I think he's very much. If you listen to him, or if you've seen him, he pretty much, when he's not working, he's in his painting studio from first thing in the morning till the end of the day. I think he talks when he wants to talk. I don't think he pays much attention to when people are having a go at him, or he certainly, I think in that space, the Twitterati and all that sort of stuff, I don't think he's any interest in that. I don't think he cares one jot what people are saying about him.
So, who does he consider his biggest influences?
Woody Guthrie for sure, Dylan for definite, and he would talk very passionately about Rolling Stones as a youth. I guess all those things, all three of those would seem pretty obvious, but I think he's also massively into black music, Motown, soul. There was a radio station, the name of which escapes me at the moment, that he listened to, or he could pick up. I think it broadcast out of Chicago, and he could pick it up in Indiana, which is a black music station. And he had James Brown, lots of Motown stuff there. His first band, Crept Soul, were a mixed race band, and doing soul covers. So he's outside of the inevitable folk and rock influences, yeah, huge fan of Motown, huge fan of soul music, huge fan of people like Stevie Wonder as well.
What do you think people would be surprised to learn about him?
I always think that I think the most surprising thing is just how good of a painter he is. I think that, when you say rock star painter, you tend to think, well, you do think of Dylan and dear old Ronnie Wood. And, that's, My Small Child with Crayons is about on the level of some of their work. But John's really good. I mean, he's very, very good. He's properly trained. He's properly passionate about it. The last time his work was exhibited in New York, it was alongside Robert Rauschenberg, who's, one of the giants of American contemporary art, and they were mounted on the same level. And the gallery that mounted it, New York gallery that mounted it, the American Gallery of Contemporary Art, felt that it was appropriate that he should be there. And I think that's the biggest surprise, that and how passionate he is about his painting. It's at least on the level of his music. He spends hours and hours and hours at it, and I think that's. He's not a dilettante. I think that's the most. When he does something, he does it all in or nothing. And I think if he hadn't been able to paint to that level, he would have stopped. He certainly wouldn't have put himself in the public arena and done it on the back of his name.
I found it interesting to learn that he wrote a musical with Stephen King. Do you know how that all came about?
I do, yeah. But the first time I went to interview him, it was at his house, and he drove me down to the house at a terrifying speed on the back of this John Deere tractor, because there's a lot of John that's trying to intimidate you. And we stood out on the sort of the deck in the house, front deck in the house by the pool. And he there's an island. He lives off on the shores of Lake Monroe in Indiana, southern Indiana. And he pointed over to a little island on the far shore, and he bought a cabin over there. And he was telling the story. He said his son had gone and stayed in the cabin, and people he knew had gone and stayed in the cabin, and they told him it was haunted. His road manager had, and he was having no truck with that. And he said, so he went over and stayed there one night, and he said he could hear noises, all the rest of it. And he ran out screaming, did some research into it, and he found this story that two brothers are down in the cabin. They got an argument over a girl one night. And one brother had killed the other brother, driven off, and he'd gone into the lake and drowned. And that was the source. He wrote that story out, was trying to think of someone appropriate to turn it into a musical. And because he's John Mellencamp, he was able to send it to Stephen King. He did tell me he'd sold the cabin not long after he'd spent the terrifying night there, because he wasn't warned when he bought it. Nobody told him. So I did ask him if he'd warn the people who bought it off him that it was haunted, and he neglected to do that.
What do you think he's going to do now for the rest of his life? He's going to continue doing music?
I think he'll continue. Yeah, I think he'll continue doing music. He'll continue creating. I know he's got a new record coming out in October. I know for a fact he's working on another musical, which is based on the lyric that he wrote to Jack and Diane. The original lyric for Jack and Diane was about a mixed race couple. So I think that's the thread. Musically, he was working on that, and they were casting that right before everybody went into lockdown. And he'll continue to paint. I think, you know, he bangs on about, in latter life, he's banged on about this quite a lot, the idea that he doesn't feel fulfilled in any day if he hasn't created something. So I'm sure he will go on. Even if it's just if he decides to keep on touring. If not, I'm sure he'll go on making music for himself. He'll go on painting, and he'll go on engaging in other projects that interest him.
So how is his family, and how was his family with all of his success?
I think they're tremendously proud. I mean, I spoke to his brother Joe, and like all siblings, Joe said, you know, enormously proud of him. Enormously protective of him, and then Joe would insist that he had a better singing voice than John and had all along. but you know, his father Richard's in his 90s now and still works for him, and still does stuff for him. I spoke to both of his daughters, Teddy Joe and Justice, and I think that genuine wonder and respect at what he did, because they know better than anybody where he came from. And what it took for him to get to where he got to, and to stay in that. So I think, yeah, I think tremendous pride, and the family. Yeah, there's not a bad word to be said in the family about him and what he's done.
So now he had a nickname, Little Bastard. What was that?
I think that was. There's various versions of that. I think there's a one is. A guy called Don Gahan, who produced his early records, he also produced R.E.M. He and John, he claims that he gave it to John. I think John claims he gave it to himself. But I think the notion that's exactly how he behaved. He said to me that when he was in his 30s, he said he came from a family of people, a family of men who didn't ask questions. They just hit. And he tried to convince himself that he would grow up to be a more measured and balanced individual than that. And he said when he got into his 30s, he realized he hadn't, and he was exactly the same. So I think it's a name that's exactly what he was. He that's how he behaved. That's what he was. Probably right up until he was in his mid 30s, early 40s.
Do you think he's happy now?
That's a really good question, because I asked his brother Joe, I asked his daughters, I asked a guy called Gary Bobinger, who went to school with him and knew him from school, what was the one question they'd ask him, and all of them said, ask him if he's happy. And his brother Joe said, I hope so, and I think in lots of other cases, genuinely not sure. I think happy. I think he's very. I think probably happy in several respects. Content? No, I don't think he'll ever be content. I think he's one of those guys who he's always moving on to the next thing. And if that works and if he's satisfied by that, then there's something else he ought to be doing and doing better. So I'm not sure he ever just sits and takes stock. No.
Well, you know, it's got to be hard from that place because a lot of people, you know, they think they know him and they'll say things about him. And how do you fight that? How do you know? You know, it's a weird business. So, yeah, pretty interesting. So what about you? What's next for you? Are you going to be doing another biography yourself? Or?
Yeah, I'm actually just, I guess in the early stage, I'm doing a book on Elliot Smith, you know, the guy who did the soundtrack to Good Will Hunting, which is a brilliant singer-songwriter, a fascinating story, but quite a dark story as well. So I've just started work on that, and we'll be on that for the next 12 months or so.
Hmm. How do you decide who you're going to write about?
Exactly that thing, just people I like, people whose stories I think are interesting and that you think, I mean, it's like with John, I think there'd been a couple of books on John, but they were a long time ago and a lot's happened since then. So the sense that there was a story there to tell, the same with Elliot Smith, the same with John, with John Entwistle, there'd been nothing. And he always seemed the missing link in the Who story. So it's that combination that there's a story there to be told. And then I think you've got to care about the story and be passionate about the person's music to commit the amount of time it takes to do these things, to want to do them.
Do you have a process that you go through to do the research for books like these?
I do, but it's probably probably the most tremendously boring thing in the world.
We all want to know.
You'd be best served watching paint dry. The research tends to happen first and then the interviews, but what I try to do is almost like a jigsaw puzzle. You're building how the book's going to work and flow as you're going about it. So, you know, things are slotted into place. So at the end of the period in research and the interviews, hopefully you've got three times as many words as you want, but they're in some kind of logical order that you're going to tell the story. And you know, it changes as you start writing inevitably, but you've set your own sort of route map towards doing it.
Interesting. I wonder if there any other famous people or even not famous, like just people he liked to play guitar with or do things with artistically just to do them?
He went, Stephen King tells a story that the first time they actually physically met, John, I think Stephen King's got a house down in Florida and John went down there to work on the musical. And Stephen King had a guitar in the corner of the room and Mellencamp picked it up and just tuned it for him and was fairly dismissive of the fact that it was so badly tuned. I'd hesitate to say slumming. I think John's one of John's great quotes is I never played well with the other boys. And I think he probably goes on like that. I know on the new record, Bruce Springsteen has played on tracks from the record and he has, you know, he's collaborated with Roseanne Cash and other people. But I think he prefers his own company by and large. I certainly don't think that he's the sort of guy who's, you know, inviting the guy who runs the local bar to come up and have a jam with him.
Right. Yeah. Do you think he has sort of a purpose when he writes his songs? Like, is there a lot of meaning behind all of his songs that he's put out?
Yeah, I mean, increasingly, yeah. I mean, I think certainly in the last two decades of his career, that there's a narrative he's telling. He's, you know, he's writing from the point of view of a man of a certain age. He's touching on mortality. I think the way he writes it, he talks about it brilliantly. I think he said he claims that, you know, songwriters can learn to tune your antennae, and he claims, you know, the process almost, you're not influencing the process, it just happens. So when he's painting, you'll be sat with the guitar next to him, and he said he'll just pluck a song out of the atmosphere because he's tuned into it. A melody will float through the air, and he'll pick it up, put down the paintbrush, write a song in 5 minutes, go back to painting. And it's interesting. I interviewed Rick Rubin at one point, and he was telling me Tom Petty was exactly the same. He said you could be talking to Tom, because Rubin worked with Petty. He said you could be having a conversation with Tom Petty over a cup of coffee, and Petty would just stop, pick up a guitar, and write a song. And it was literally that much in the moment that. I think maybe you've been doing it so long, you're just able to pluck these things out of the ether.
Wow. Yeah. Pretty incredible. What's this new album going to be about? Does he sort of say, or do you don't know?
I think it's very much in the tradition of the records he's made over the last few years. I think starting with Freedom's Road and Life, Definitely from Freedom, the one he made with T-Bone Burnett, very much in the American folk tradition, generally quite sparse and acoustic, and songs about mortality and life from the perspective of a late 60, 70 year old man. I think it will be in exactly that place again. I don't think he's for turning now. I think he makes music for himself and to please himself first and foremost. So I think it'll be very much in that tradition.
Yeah, yeah. Did he ever get married then, or how's his relationship life?
A few times, yeah. Yeah, three times. I think he was married. Syl was his first wife when he eloped across the state line to marry Syl in Louisville in Kentucky when he was, I think if memory serves, 19 years old. Second wife, yeah, three wives. Elaine, the longest, Elaine Mellencamp, for model, and that and since then he's been involved on and off with Meg Ryan. So yeah, he's had a colourful and eventful love life, shall we say.
Yeah, I guess. Any children?
Five children, three daughters, two sons. Daughter with Syl, the two sons with Elaine, Hud and Speck. Yeah, so five children.
Wow. It good relationships with them too? Everything's good?
Yeah, insofar as it can be, yes. There's no, I think everybody's maintained dignified silences or been quite complimentary. His first wife still worked for him. She picked out a wedding dress for his second wife, so I think that was wow. That was fairly amicable. No particularly poisonous stories or quotes or anything like that. I think that the people I spoke to, because as I said, Meg Ryan's been on and off. They were engaged and that broke off. And I spoke to a very good friend of John's. He said that he thought that it was just at this stage of both of their lives, John's just so used to living his own life and doing things his own way. It's very difficult to accommodate someone else full time in that kind of thing. And the same with Meg Ryan, I think.
Hmm. Yeah, it'd be that way. Wow. So now I guess the book, of course, will be sold everywhere. And do you have a website yourself, too, that people can come find all your books?
No, I'm going the John route with that. I tend to communicate by carrier pigeon. And
staying out of the spotlight.
No. Yeah, I think that's, you know, I think publishers, I'm very Simon Schuster publishing this book, so I think I'm in about as good a hands as you can be. And I think they do that thing, sort of thing, far, far better than I do. So I will entrust that to them.
Yeah, yeah. Not going to get in any Twitter wars or anything like that.
No, not going to.
Well, you're no fun. Oh, boy.
It's been said.
Yeah, we'll make something up, okay? And then we'll get them going, talking about you. Well, certainly another great book featuring another great rock star. So, of course, the book is called Mellencamp, and our guest is the author, Paul Rees. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, gents. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Paul.
tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll tell you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.